One person who opted for golf over watching the World Cup final was the president. Mr. Obama was relaxing during some time off ahead of another big battle in Washington. The Senate is planning to take up the bill that would rewrite rules for the financial industry. Exactly when it comes to the Senate floor depends on when the Democrats feel confident they'll have enough votes to protect themselves from a Republican filibuster. We're joined now by NPR's Cokie Roberts. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
What is likely to happen when the Senate takes up that financial overhaul bill?
Well, as you say, they're waiting to see if they get the votes to stop a filibuster, and that means waiting for West Virginia Governor Joe Manchin to name someone to replace Senator Robert Byrd, who, of course, died recently, to get that 60th vote. And even then, it's somewhat up in the air. You know, the Republicans are out making arguments about a government takeover of everything, of the financial industry, of health care, of student loans, and those are really become the talking points. And it's scaring Republicans who are ready to deal on the financial services bill and giving a lot of ammunition to those who say, no, we aren't going to cooperate with the Democrats on anything. And they're getting more ammunition from the president's own deficit commission that was talking over the weekend to the National Governors Association, warning that the national debt is a cancer on the society. And, you know, this is makes it really hard for Democrats to pass anything that's going to cost any money.
And Cokie, yesterday, White House aides fanned out across the Sunday talk shows to defend the president. Public opinion polls over the last few weeks have shown Mr. Obama losing ground among that really key group, independent voters.
And that losing enormous amounts of ground among independents. And that had the president's own spokesman, Robert Gibbs, warning that the Democrats could lose the House of Representatives. Here he is on NBC's Meet the Press.
I think there's no doubt there are enough seats in play that could cause Republicans to gain control. There's no doubt about that.
Now, it's instructive that Gibbs was the person talking on one of the talk shows yesterday. David Axelrod, the president's advisor, was on several others. You know, this tells you what the administration wants to be talking about at any given time. They decide who's going to go on the Sunday shows. And it wasn't, say, the Secretary of State or the Secretary of Defense or even the Secretary of Energy in the middle of the BP oil crisis. It was the president's advisors, his political advisors, and they are trying to get out the message that there's a real problem here. And what they're really trying to do is to energize that group of people who came out in 2008 and voted for President Obama, put him over the top. And that means young people, it means women, it means minorities, and it does mean independents. And at the moment, that is a tremendous problem for them.
Okay, very briefly, Republicans see a number of issues that could help them in November. Immigration, one of them. Do you think they're right?
They could be right in the short term. It's a tough issue for them in the long term, but the administration has, as you know, filed suit against the Arizona law and says that they might file yet another one if that law results in racial profiling. So they're trying to energize the Hispanic vote.
NPR News Analyst Cokie Roberts, thanks very much.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. If this next story were a movie, it would be tough to watch. But it's no movie. It's the latest disturbing turn in the life of the actor Mel Gibson. And a word of warning here. What you're about to hear is unsavory, and it may not be appropriate for young listeners. We're talking about audio that was posted by the website Radar Online. It's audio of a conversation, apparently between Gibson and his now ex-girlfriend, Oksana Grigorieva. The two are engaged in a nasty custody battle over their infant daughter. On the recording, the man alleged to be Gibson sounds unhinged, cursing wildly, at times panting to catch his breath as he verbally abuses Grigorieva. At one point, he says, "You deserved it," when she accuses him of physically hitting her. For more on this story, I'm joined by Los Angeles Times film writer John Horn. John, welcome to the program. The tapes in question surfaced over the weekend and late last week. What do we know about how and when these tapes were allegedly recorded?
They were apparently allegedly recorded by his ex-girlfriend, secretly and I suspect without his knowledge or consent, which is a minor legal question in the bigger picture.
Now, you say that they were released. She is claiming that she did not leak them. So do we know anything about who did provide them?
We don't know, and Radar has not said who. No one yet has disputed the authenticity of it, but it's not clear from where it came.
You know, actors are individuals, but they're almost like small corporations. There are a lot of people whose livelihoods are attached to their success. So when you're talking about Mel Gibson's future, you're actually talking about the futures of a lot of people. But first, I want to just talk about the actor, if I can. There's a big question about what this will mean for his future. Could this be the end of the line for his career?
I think absolutely. I mean, he has not made any he's made one studio movie in the last 8 years, and that was a film called Edge of Darkness that was mildly but not greatly successful. He has another movie on the shelf called The Beaver with Summit, which is the company that did the Twilight movies, and he has starred in an independently financed movie that has yet got a distribution deal. There's two businesses that Mel Gibson is in. He is a filmmaker who kind of self-finances his own works. He did so with Apocalypto, and he did so with The Passion of the Christ. And then there's the actor. And one is kind of a standalone business that he can do it on his own. But as an actor, you are in a very collaborative business and you need people to want to work with you. And I can't imagine a lot of people wanting to work with him right now.
So is this really about morality or bankability?
Unfortunately, I think it's really about bankability. I mean, there have been other actors and some of them are quite successful right now. Charlie Sheen is involved in a domestic violence case. He's working steadily. Alec Baldwin called his daughter a thoughtless little pig. He's working steadily. I won't say that these are quite as extreme as what Mel Gibson said, although unlike Sheen, he wasn't arrested. I think it's more the compendium of his insults, that he has offended blacks. There's an allegation that he made a derogatory comment about Latinos. He's offended women. He previously had offended Jews. And I don't know who's left.
When you listen to the audio, and it is very disturbing, hard to get through all 8 minutes of it, he makes several threats against his ex-girlfriend. He talks about burning down her house. She talks about allegedly being punched by him and losing a couple of teeth. Are there any legal charges here?
Potentially. I mean, the local law enforcement is looking into it. And I think this is probably why these tapes exist, that they were given over to law enforcement or some lawyers and they came out that way. You know, if he is making threats against this woman, he's, you know, threatening to kill her. I think he says at one point that she'll be in, I'll leave out the adjective, the Rose Garden. Yeah, absolutely. I think there's the potential for some sort of criminal case against Mr. Gibson. So the end or the potential end of his career is only one of his problems right now.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
That's Los Angeles Times film writer John Horn. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. It's a friendly online world out there, fun to connect with old schoolmates on MySpace and Facebook, and to catch up with coworkers on LinkedIn. But for anyone with something to hide, Vanessa Romo reports that you might want to think twice about that next friend request.
As soon as he got the call, Isaac McNair knew he was busted.
I've been known to be a rabscallion from time to time, and I've had some credit problems because of that.
McNair is a 35-year-old solar panel salesman with a slew of credit problems. His credit is so bad that
I can't buy a car, a house, or a gumball, but if I use cash, I can do whatever I want.
He owes the Department of Education just under $15,000 in student loans. But for more than a decade, he's managed to evade collection agencies and their skip tracers. Those are the people collection agencies hire to find delinquents like McNair.
I've always had jobs as waiters or jobs that last summers or a couple of years and a bit of a gypsy. So it's really impossible to track me down. And there's even been times in my life where they found me and I've just quit the job so that I didn't have to deal with it.
But 2 weeks ago, McNair says he unwittingly set his own trap.
My bosses actually asked me to use Facebook as a social networking tool for meeting other people in the solar field. So I did that, and I put my full contact information on there for the first time. So within one day of putting my work information on Facebook, the secretary gets a call from some lady who totally gets my name wrong, and I pick up the phone, and they're like, is Mr. Isaac Vicknar there? And I was like, oh, I've heard this call before.
The woman on the other end of the line was contacting him on behalf of a Bureau of the United States Department of Treasury responsible for collecting monies owed to the government. They were threatening to garnish his wages unless he set up a payment plan. Collection agencies, like everyone else, are now using social networking sites to track down or keep tabs on people they're interested in.
It's incredible the kind of information that people put out there about themselves.
Gary Nitzkin is a credit collection attorney with his own firm, Nitzkin & Associates. He says Vicknar got off easy. Nitzkin's employees go even further than just searching MySpace, LinkedIn, or Facebook.
My collectors and skip tracers will put their name in to be a friend to the debtor. Are they going boating today on their new sailboat? Well, guess what? We just found an asset that we can take.
Is this legal?
Is it legal?
Yeah.
You know, that's a very interesting question. On the surface of it, I can tell you there's nothing illegal about it.
Maybe that's because the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, FDCPA for short, was written in 1978, before social media existed. The statute protects debtors from being harassed and also prohibits collectors from doing or saying anything that's false or misleading. The Federal Trade Commission enforces the act, and when asked if it is legal for a collections agent to friend a debtor online without mentioning the debt, the FTC sent this email response.
The FDCPA mandates that collectors must disclose that they are attempting to collect on a debt, and any information obtained will be used for that purpose. It also requires that collectors state in subsequent communication with the debtor that they are a debt collector. A collector's failure to make these disclosures would violate Section 807.11.
If you ask defense attorneys, they will tell you that what I do is underhanded, sneaky, and completely uncalled for.
But Nitzkin argues it's a gray area for now.
If you ask my colleagues, the plaintiff attorneys that collect these debts, we're laughing. We think it's a wonderful thing.
As for Isaac Vicknar, he's given up hiding and made arrangements to pay off most of his debt.
The dark horse is there's one more out there waiting to find me on Facebook. And maybe they haven't, and maybe they will through this story. It'll be interesting.
For NPR News, I'm Vanessa Romo.
Finally, I have a few words about To Kill a Mockingbird, that famous novel by Harper Lee, which was made into an equally, if not more famous film, was published 50 years ago yesterday. I read that novel, and I have to say watched that film, long before I probably should have. I lived in a household in which we were free to read anything we could get our hands on, the parental theory being, I suppose, that we would filter out anything we didn't understand. Which was right most of the time, except perhaps on one weekend where I terrified myself by reading The Exorcist in one marathon day-long sitting, which left me afraid to fall asleep for one marathon night. But that's another story. Anyway, the world that Harper Lee described was fascinating to me for several reasons, not least because it was the world from which my grandparents had come, but of which they never spoke. My father's people, as they say, were from South Carolina. My mother's from Virginia. But that history was poured out in only the tiniest sips and then bottled back up. Most of the time, the cap stayed on tight. Once my father talked of his mother having been hidden in the root cellar as a child to protect her from the predations of night riders. Needless to say, we had no idea what night riders were. My mother allowed us to how her family was raised north because her father had had to leave home after one too many confrontations with his own father over how his father was treating his mother. Sounds Freudian enough until it emerged, in another sip of information, that my grandfather's father was white, his mother black. Always more to the story. Never to be revealed. So here was Harper Lee offering yet more of a world that could have been familiar but was not. That world seems so different than the polyglot world in which I was raised in New York. My best friends, or rather their parents, had come, not from the apartheid South, but in many cases from across the water. Pat's were from Barbados, Leslie's from Costa Rica, Angel's from Puerto Rico, Larry's mother was from Japan, and the Lchanov twins, whose mother always seemed to send enough dumplings to share, were from Russia. Our friend Ruth invited all of us to her bat mitzvah. Everything from bologna to beans and rice would be brought to lunch, and the one thing we all had in common was that nobody wanted to eat whatever it was that his or her mother had packed. It sounds idyllic, and in some ways it was, until it wasn't. It was years before the uglier side of that world became understood to me anyway, about the apartments that were offered to my light-skinned father only to be mysteriously unavailable when his dark-skinned wife and children, us, showed up, the taxis who refused to transport my mother with a sick child when my father was at work and couldn't get away, not to mention the increasingly crowded schools where the resources seemed to get fewer and fewer as the students got darker and darker. Which was probably why, even though I did not understand everything about the world that Scout and Jim and Atticus and Boo Radley and Tom Robinson lived in, I understood enough. At that age, all I really knew was that some people were nice and some people were mean. But it was shocking to me to contemplate how easily people could be designated for mistreatment solely because of the color of their skin. And as the novel intended, it was also a relief and a reminder that advocates and allies come in every color. I haven't read that novel in a long, long time. I'm wondering if it's time to pick it up again, to be reminded that otherwise decent people will look the other way at wrongdoing, and that sometimes other decent people will cross the room to stand up for those who deserve it and are standing alone. I'm glad I read that book when I did, before the cynicism of a later age made that obvious truth harder to see. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.